And welcome to a special live edition of Talking History. I'm Jerry Zahavi, and with me in the studios is Professor Thomas Summerhill, Associate Professor of History from Michigan State University, and the author, most recently, of Harvest of Dissent, Agrarianism in 19th Century New York. And Tom is actually an old acquaintance from Syracuse University. We crossed paths when he was finishing up his master's degree in the mid-80s, and I had just finished up my PhD and on my way. So welcome, Tom.
Well, thank you very much, Jerry. It's good to be here.
I want to start off by talking about the big picture and a little introduction to you and your interest in agricultural history, because that's what you're doing. You're doing a history of rural America, and so why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got interested in these topics in the first place?
Sure. Well, as you know, a lot of the kind of work that we do is something that we've come upon in the process of doing our work. And when I first got to Syracuse University, I was in a local history seminar and had to come up with some sort of a topic to write about. And I thought about, well, the city where I was from, Oneonta, New York, was a very large railroad, had a very large railroad industry there, the largest roundhouse in the world at the time, and huge rail yards for the Delaware and Hudson Railroad Company. And I didn't really know why that was there. So I wrote a study of the development of the railroad in Oneonta, New York. Along the way, and here's where things got interesting, I found that there was a lot of opposition to the construction of the road. And this was not something that I had read about in any other studies of railroads. And it certainly didn't jive with how we thought in the late 20th century about the utility of railroads and the relative impact of railroads, which was always seen as positive and obvious to everybody. So when I went to the University of California at San Diego to do my PhD, I decided I would look at the opposition to the railroads and then try to see if there were other movements in upstate New York that seemed to give the sort of anti-corporate kind of message that these people had during the fight over the railroad in the 1850s. What I found was that actually upstate New York farmers were, well, angry a lot, in fact. And there were, stretching from the 1840s with the anti-rent movement, through the fight over the Albany and Susquehanna Railroad, through the Grange movement at the end of the 19th century, farmers were consistently arguing for a very particular idea about what politics, society ought to be like. And so I decided to tell that story.
You told that story in the form of?
In a dissertation, which is now a book, after a lot of cutting and trimming. When you sit down to write a book as a dissertation, you have some basic ideas as to what it is that you think you're going to write about. And I was most interested in the relationship of farmers to the emerging capitalist economy in 19th century America. And I certainly found plenty of opposition to that and plenty of language expressed by farmers that showed a great deal of anxiety about that.
There aren't that many people these days who are doing agricultural history or the history of farmers. It seems like more and more people are focusing on women's history, African American history. They were focusing on labor history, mainly urban workers, industrial workers. What's happened to agricultural history and agricultural historians? I know that Cornell University used to be a center of that back in the 1950s. Mm-hmm. What's happened in the last half century to that?
Well, the Cornell folks, I think, were very much at the crest of the wave of progressive historians. And progressives from the late 19th century right up through the New Deal were very interested in trying to find ways to make agriculture with a family farm model at the center of it sustainable. And they placed a lot of emphasis on reforms that would allow those kinds of operations to maintain themselves, because at that time, they were seen as cornerstones of the American experiment. And after the war, subsidies tended to go to much larger producers, and the smaller producers began to fall out of production, and people left farming as an occupation. As a result, less people knew what happened on farms, quite honestly, so that by the 70s, farms, even in places like upstate New York, where they had once been prosperous, might living memory. I can remember how many farms there were, how well kept they were, and so on and so forth. You know, they began to disappear. People moved to suburbs, small towns made a transition to light industry or service economies or tourist economies. As a result, people just don't have a sort of intuitive understanding of why farming might be interesting to study. And I think that's really reflected in the profession these days. That said, I think New York and a few other places have seen a kind of renaissance in agricultural history or rural history in the last 15 to 20 years. I think it's a long time coming because we can find out an awful lot about the United States and its values and its enduring debates by looking at rural places.
Well, it is, and it's ironic because farmers really and agrarianism and Republican ideology was really founded on farmers, and right. The whole notion of independent production and Jeffersonianism was rooted in that. And somehow through the 19th century, as we became an industrial country, we left a lot of that behind, didn't right. we? And you're dealing with that in the book in many ways.
I am. One of the things that, particularly for the North, people have not really thought about how farmers responded to modernization. I'll use that just as the catch basin term to describe industrialization, urbanization, and the expansion of capitalism. Because those farmers did not join movements like the populists at the end of the 19th century, people have tended to just assume that they were very much in step with other people who were advocating modernization in the Northeast. What I set out to do was try to tell a counter story, because I kept finding evidence that they, in fact, were not. I think their idea of a Jeffersonian republic, and certainly all of the groups that I talk about in this book embrace this to some extent or another, relied on democracy and localism to protect small producers from larger interests that could organize much more effectively, mobilize politically much more effectively, and therefore, for lack of a better term, make silent farmers. Now, the sad part of my story, I suppose, is that the farmers lose. By the end of the 19th century, it's quite clear that their message and themselves are being shouldered out of politics. Nonetheless, they didn't go out without a fight, and many of the progressive reforms of the early 19th century were actually the kinds of things that were asked for by farmers in the late 19th century. Income tax, direct election of senators, a national agricultural policy, and a whole variety of others. So they did leave their mark on modern America, but in the process, they ended up being shunted aside.
Yeah, I think back at some of my own research and how farmers are treated by the folks that I study, and I've been working on a book on American communism, and of course communists always viewed farmers, like most communists viewed farmers as a reactionary force.
Right.
In America and in China and in Europe and anywhere in the world, that there were a special problem that you had to deal with by five-year plans or anything else, collectivization and whatever. And in many ways, I think historians have that view today. So I think it's refreshing to have your book. Now, you chose to do a very local study of farmers. It's a study of farmers in central New York, particularly in three counties.
Otsego, Schoharie, and Delaware.
Why did you choose those counties?
Well, part of it was the accident of having started a study of Oneonta, New York, which is in Otsego County, and finding plenty of archival material that would sustain a study of agrarian protest. However, these counties also shared a common history in the manorial system of eastern New York. They were largely settled by large landowners who created a series of tenancy relationships of one kind or another. Some would result in ultimate freeholding of the land. Some held tenants in their contracts in perpetuity. But by and large, they had this same common history, and many of their struggles in the 1830s and 1840s, including anti-rent, were designed to lift the yoke of landlordism off of the shoulders of farmers. So they all shared this, and they then also all became involved to one degree or another in dairying and hops production. So there were common kinds of economic developments and crop strategies that would allow me then to gauge how much farmers were influenced by these factors in making their political and economic decisions.
Well, what's the significance of, you mentioned dairy and crop production, what's the significance of that type of production?
Well, for me, and the book is very much centered in the middle and toward the end of the book on hops production. And hops production is critical because unlike a lot of other crops that are grown in small amounts, this is a very high-value crop. It's a very specialized type of farming in order to produce a good, marketable product. And it takes a lot of capital investment in order to put in a crop of hops, to build a hop kiln to dry them, and then get them off to market. If you make any mistakes with hops along the way during production, they're spoiled and they lose their value. Well, this was not a kind of a crop that people entered into lightly. And in fact, most of them were drawn into the market, much like in the South with cotton, through essentially coercive rent contracts, which almost had the character in some ways of labor contracts. So hops became a sort of engine by which national markets penetrated into this area. And with that, the market did not bring freedom. It brought unfreedom in the form of having to do these.
Well, let's take it slowly and more chronologically.
Sure.
Where does your book begin? How do you and what are the initial crops? What are the circumstances of farmers when we first meet them in the late 18th, early 19th century?
Otsego, Schoharie, and Delaware were all settled in the 1790s after the Revolution and were the first touching points of the great Yankee migration that swept across New York State at that time. At the time, landlords asked the tenants, incoming tenants, or even freeholders in some cases, to pay off mortgages to grow wheat. And so there was a sustained attempt to grow wheat in this area. It was a marketable crop that had a pretty good market value, could be transported and so forth. But they also engaged in various mixed farming that was quite consistent with frontier agriculture. They tapped maple trees and floated the maple sugar to market. They distilled whiskey and a variety of things like this, made butter and so forth. They hunted and floated lumber down to Philadelphia took the lumber across the mountains to Albany or to New York City and so forth. But by the 1830s, there was a transition underway to more pasture-oriented agriculture, wool first and dairy second. And then in the 1830s and 1840s, large-scale capitalist investors wanted to make the transition to hops as a high market value crop. And it was dairy and hops that ultimately then defined the history of these two areas in the 19th century.
And so far in the period we're looking at early on, it's a land lease system, very large landowners in this area?
Especially Schoharie and Delaware County, mm-hmm. A little less so in Otsego County. What's interesting to me is that in spite of the fact that Otsego County had a much more open land system, they still had a very vibrant agrarian community and a very vocal agrarian protest history.
Now, many of the farmers that leased land also owned their own land, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
Well, that's usually not really discussed, at least in the literature I'm familiar with, and I'm only superficially familiar with this literature.
Right.
Explain that a little bit.
Well, this is partly historical accident. Some landlords wanted to sell parcels of land in almost a checkerboard system in order to draw a few freeholders in and then lease the land later to others or vice versa. So as part of a marketing strategy on the part of the large landholders, you would get these kinds of mixes. And as families tried to expand their farming operations, they might have to rent or buy a plot of land nearby in order to maintain their production or expand it to meet the needs of growing families and so forth. And I call this hidden tenancy in the book. And I think if one were to go back and just do a census sample and find that people actually own some real estate, they would see them as being freeholders. And as a result, they would overestimate just how free these people were from these sort of more coercive contracts. And they would therefore underestimate the relative sincerity of a lot of the agrarian protest that's going on. Might see them really as sort of capitalists on the make who are just simply being restrained by these older social relations. But I found something else, that actually a lot of freeholders were tied to landlords or were just simply not masters of their domain in the kind of traditional way that we think about yeoman farmers. So by understanding those relationships, you can see the depth and urgency of the agrarian agitation of the 19th century much easier.
Were they part of a broad capitalist market even as early as the 1820s or... Oh, was this on its way to being made?
It was on its way to being made. Okay. And certainly the proprietors who owned the land wanted to, they had a vision that they wanted to transform this land into thriving agricultural villages, almost on an English model. And that this would make good their investments and make them very wealthy people indeed. And they hoped that in the process of cultivating market relations, they would also instill in the farmers themselves a sort of mentality of progress and growth that the proprietors thought would be very Republican in its character and help promote American democracy. And so this is why they tried to push wheat. William Cooper tried to push maple sugaring, and they came up with all sorts of different kinds of plans in order to draw these people in and give them a kind of a purpose in life. The flip side of this story is that obviously they held the common farmer in a little bit of contempt and didn't think that without this kind of incentive that they would actually produce or become virtuous or productive citizens.
What was the relationship between these landed elites and the farmers themselves during this time?
Well, it was tense. Stretching back into the early 18th century, there had been land riots in New York all along the Hudson Valley. These have been studied by a number of people, most recently Thomas Humphrey, whose book Liberty and Freedom, I think is the title of it, just came out from Northern Illinois Press. So there had been a constant battle over land, and the farmers of the Hudson Valley equated land ownership with freedom, with democracy, with access to all of the rights and duties and responsibilities and liberties of citizenship. So as you enter the period that I study in the 1790s and on, farmers expected that coming out of the Revolution that they would be given access to land so that they could then move forward into becoming good Republican citizens. Landlords stood in the way of that. And so there was always tension over land ownership and rights to the land and who should have them and why.
The area you're looking at, Delaware, Otsego, and Schoharie, were not part of the Hudson Valley. They're to the west.
Yeah, that's right.
And they're further away from major transportation links to the marketplace.
Right.
Now, many historians really emphasize the importance of these rivers and natural transportation links between markets and the Atlantic economy. Mm-hmm. And the further inland you go, the traditional view is that the market mentality took longer to penetrate those areas. Was that the case with Delaware Otsego? Did it take longer to penetrate those areas? Were they self-sufficient yeoman farmers there? The original question behind it is to what extent the capitalist mentality, capitalist agriculture had penetrated that region.
I think that to a certain extent, landlord critics of these farmers were right. They wished to practice extensive agriculture, what we would today call Swidden, where you go and chop down a bit of forest, plant your corn in the ashes and the accumulated humus there, raise a good crop, and then when that gave out, move on to the next plot. They basically were eating up lots of land, but it took very little work to do this. They would have preferred to raise cattle or sheep or something like this, where they wouldn't have to have high labor inputs, precisely because they didn't think that they could easily get the products to market. It would eat up the costs. So I guess one way of thinking of it is that they grew things that didn't take a lot of labor and could either walk or float to market. So that's why you see things like dairy products, maple sugar, whiskey, anything that can be concentrated or can get on its own legs and head off somewhere. That's what they grew. They also understood, I think, quite readily that if they invested a lot of labor or capital in their operations, they might lose their title to the land, and they didn't want to do that. So they followed much more conservative strategies. There was a certain economic logic to it.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean landlords accepted this. They still wanted to push for market agriculture, especially wheat and other high-value products.
And how did they get the products to the market from that particular region? What rivers did they use?
Well, the Susquehanna and the Delaware were the main arteries out.
Mm-hmm.
And in the spring, when the snow melted, these men built arks and they floated down to Philadelphia or to Harrisburg or someplace like that and sold the stuff and then walked back.
Over those rapids, huh?
Yeah.
I've been at some of those rapids, so it's not easy.
No, it's not. Well, these were hardy people, as I try to say in the book.
Yeah, you're giving us some nice examples of hardy people in there. So let's go work our way through the first act of resistance. You write about the anti-rent movement.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us the origins of that movement and what happened in the late 1830s.
Well, to some extent, as I was just saying, there's a colonial precedent for anti-rent and these struggles over land. But after the Revolution, this grew much more vocal. For small farmers in central New York, they believed that the Revolution had been fought for small proprietors of their land or artisans or people like that to have access to productive resources. The land system appeared to them to be intensely unrepublican because it placed small farmers under the thumb of a landlord class that didn't seem to work very hard but seemed to get an awful lot of money from them. This just struck them as completely wrong. And over the course of the early 19th century, they staged a number of title suits and other legal actions to try to declare the titles to these large landholdings null and void, for any of a variety of technical reasons that I talk about in the book and have been discussed by other people elsewhere. Having failed at all of these remedies, when Stephen Van Rensselaer III, the great patroon who owned Albany and Rensselaer counties, died in 1839, his heirs attempted to collect all of the back rents that were owed to the estate, which he had allowed to accumulate quite extensively in order to buy off peace, in order to buy peace on his estate over the years. What happened is that tenants then formed an anti-rent association, petitioned for redress, and Van Rensselaer heirs simply refused to back down. As a result, they formed Calico Indian Bands. These were tenants disguised as Indians in very brightly colored calico smocks and masks, sometimes sheepskin, sometimes just cotton, who then attempted to prevent sheriffs from serving process for evictions or to hold sheriff sales to make good back rents and that kind of thing. It led to the Helderberg War in 1839, where the militia from Albany came up into the Helderberg Mountains and attempted to put down this resistance. They were sent skulking back to Albany, and anti-rent began to spread into the neighboring counties as various anti-rent associations in Albany County colonized Schoharie, Rensselaer, Columbia, Delaware, Otsego counties. It spread ultimately to 11 different counties. And the one main goal of this organization was to end the manor system. Secondarily, they thought that the political system of New York allowed landlords much more power than they than they deserved and dampened democracy. And so they also began calling much more vocally as the movement progressed. So by 1845 and 1846, it had reached a fever pitch for the democratization of the state constitution, which would allow for much more elective offices at the state and local level. And they were successful in that, in alliance with other groups in these counties. However, not everything that they wanted to get actually bore fruit. They never really did get the state to vacate these titles, because the state felt that there was no way to do this legally. The American Republic had been founded on property ownership, and they could not find a constitutional way to remedy the problem.
What political forms did their resistance take in the 1840s?
Well, they became a third party by 1844. Initially, they tried petition drives, peppering the legislature of the state of New York with petitions demanding redress of one kind or another, including using eminent domain to liquidate the estates. And they were asking, actually, to just buy the land at a fair market price. They didn't even want to have a sort of socialist seizure of the land. They wanted an opportunity to buy it on the basis of them having rights to land, because their sweat, their labor, had given it its value. And so they felt that they had a perfectly good argument for this. When that didn't work, they were joined by the New York City artisans and thinkers from the National Reform Movement, who were radical free soilers. And they formed a political organization called the Anti-Rent Equal Rights Party, which then decided that it would throw its weight behind candidates from either the Whig or the Democratic parties who would support land reform. And so that's how they operated for their history. As I say in the book, I think this is exactly what killed them, because that made them subject to all sorts of maneuvering and manipulation by the different factions of the parties as they tried to get the farmer vote. And rarely did the farmers get their program advanced in the scramble between these different factions from the major parties.
Yeah, similar things have been written about the populists.
Yes.
Later on. I think, why don't we take a break right now and come back after our segment, the audio question of the week. I have a lot more to ask you, so and we haven't quite had enough time to go through it. So we'll come back right after this. But right now, we're gonna take a short break for a public service announcement and go right into our archival audio question of the week. We're here with Professor Tom Summerhill, Associate Professor of History from Michigan State University, talking about Harvest of the Scent, Agrarianism in 19th Century New York. And we'll be back in about a minute.